coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. A massive proposed data center near Delaware City faces plenty of pushback.
What some of the opponents of the current project are hoping is that public opposition can be mobilized.
Contributor John Hurdle joins us to explain the data center plan and where it goes from here. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also hear from the winner of this week's special election for a seat in the General Assembly and learn more about the threats Delaware marshes and wetlands face. And in Arts Playlist, we meet the Delaware Symphony Orchestra's new music director. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Plans to build one of the largest data centers in the country near Delaware City in Newcastle County has sparked outrage from nearby residents, while prompting state and county lawmakers to raise concerns about its impact on the environment and the electric grid. Delaware Public Media contributor John Hurdle recently offered an initial peek at the project, the reaction to it, and is tracking what's next in the process as it develops. And John joined me earlier this week to discuss where things stand. John, let's start with a quick overview of this proposed project. It is massive. Just how massive and what would it encompass and where?
It would cover 6 million square feet on two different campuses a little way north of Delaware City. Very significantly, it would require 1.2 gigawatts of electricity to run it. Now, that's a gigantic number, and it's probably bigger than the offshore wind proposals that have been now shelved across the Mid-Atlantic area. It's also 1.2 gigawatts is about twice the amount of electricity that is used by all of the homes in Delaware. And it's also bigger than the amount of power that would be that is planned to be created by the restarted unit at Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania, when that is supposed to restart in 2028. Those figures would put this proposal in some context.
And it would be, to my understanding, one of the biggest data centers nationwide, correct?
It would be one of the biggest data centers nationwide and certainly the biggest in Delaware.
So, John, the chief concern raised has to do with, as you mentioned, the project's electric needs. At a recent town hall, the project's developer, Starwood Digital Ventures, confirmed it would not generate its own power, instead drawing from the grid. Why is this a red flag for many opponents, and how could it affect ratepayers already stressed by high rates and spikes in their bills?
Well, by the way, the Starwood is not permitted to generate its own power on site, even if it wanted to, because this campus falls into the coastal zone, so it's not allowed to do that. But the concern about ratepayers is that this huge increase in electric demand would actually drive up domestic rates, it comes down to simple economics. If you've got an enormous increase in demand without a corresponding increase in supply, then that increases the risk of higher rates. And this is coming at a time when Delaware ratepayers are already paying more for their electricity. For example, in June, rates went up by about 3.5%, that was due to a variety of factors, increasing natural gas prices, and the higher cost of upgrades in transmission infrastructure. So the concern here is that this enormous increase in power demand by this center would actually that ratepayers would end up helping to shoulder that burden.
John, are there any possible solutions to either the usage or the cost issues? Is there a way to make this work?
Well, one possible solution is contained in a bill in the legislature by Democratic Representative Frank Burns. And what that would do is to require the regulated utilities to establish a special rate for big energy users, notably data centers, and that would be designed to shield ratepayers from this knock-on effect that we were talking about. There's also a proposed ordinance at the county level at Newcastle County, which would require, amongst other things, would require developers to work with utilities to show that there's enough electricity capacity or to provide their own generation. And as we were saying, Starwood has now confirmed that it will not be providing its own generation.
John, another concern is water use for cooling needs at such a center. What are the issues there?
The issues are that there would be a very heavy demand on water to in order to cool the computer servers, thousands of computer servers that are housed in these data centers. In the case of the proposed Delaware center, the water would be supplied by the utility Veolia, and that takes water from the red clay and white clay creeks, and it's unclear at the moment whether there would be enough capacity for to meet those needs. So that is an additional concern.
Are there other concerns nearby residents are raising about the presence of such a large data center project?
Well, what we hear from residents in other states, I mean, notably in Virginia, which by general admission is the sort of epicenter of U.S. data center development, and they've got dozens of new projects operating there and in the pipeline. So we hear complaints from residents about noise, 24/7 noise. Apparently, low frequency noises, constant low frequency noise, is quite bad for residents who live nearby. There's lights, constant lights, and some of those concerns are addressed in the proposals put forward at the county level.
Let's dive into that a little bit more because, as we've noted already, this project's drawn the attention of both local and state lawmakers. You alluded to Newcastle County introducing an ordinance this week to regulate some of these issues. Tell us a little bit more about what that ordinance is trying to do.
Well, that puts together a whole list of requirements. They include there would be a minimum 1,000-foot setback from residential zones, schools, and daycare centers, an 8-foot minimum berm for the buffering between the residential areas and and the data center, strict limits on noise and lighting impacts. In fact, they would set a 55 decibel noise limit, and a ban on what are called open loop cooling systems, which are the very water heavy systems that we were talking about before.
So, John, I guess one issue here is that the first phase of this project has already been submitted. Would this ordinance be something that affects that already submitted project or only on the second phase of this proposal?
It seems like it would only be on the second phase of this proposal, because the developer already has what is known as a vested right to go ahead with its plans, because it filed its application before this county ordinance was introduced.
So, John, let's head to the state level on this. House Speaker Melissa Minor Brown, who represents the district where this project is proposed, has already come out against it over its energy usage. And you reported on State Senator Hansen and the energy stakeholders group she leads already discussing this, at least to some degree. Can you tell us a little bit about what those discussions were like? And is it likely the state is going to have something to say here?
Well, yes, the Energy Stakeholders Group is a collection of utility executives, environmentalists, consumer advocates, and so on, who meet twice a month to discuss issues regarding energy in the state of Delaware. And certain legislative proposals come out of that process. Now, some of those members are certainly hoping to that bills will emerge out of those discussions, which may assert some degree of control over the over this data center project. But Senator Stephanie Hansen, who leads that group, she herself referred to the sheer scale of this project as what she called craziness. And so, I mean, I think it's fair to say that there was a lot of concern expressed in this meeting about this proposal, which had been only just unveiled shortly before that meeting. And I think that they will be returning to the subject at their next meeting in the middle of August.
And John, as we noted earlier, or you noted earlier, Delaware is not alone in facing battles over data centers, correct? This is something that's happening across the country.
Indeed, it is. There's as has been widely reported, data centers are popping up all over the place in response to the sudden demand for artificial intelligence, and I think that the kind of proposal that we're now seeing in Delaware is just an example, albeit a particularly large one, of what's going on a national level.
Interestingly enough, this is not the first time Delaware has seen a battle over a data center. There was one about a decade ago in Newark, correct?
There was indeed. And in 2014, the University of Delaware that initially proposed this data center on the old Chrysler campus dropped the idea, saying that it was concerned about the greenhouse gas emissions that would result from this, and it was also in response to very significant public protest against that project. And what some of the opponents of the current project are hoping is that that public opposition can be mobilized to the current project.
And it's interesting because that previous project in Newark actually had more backing from the state government, particularly then Governor Jack Markell, and wound up, kind of falling apart, as you mentioned, at the end when the pressure became pretty intense on the University of Delaware as it was trying to use that as part of its initial development of the Star Campus. John, I do want to just kind of wrap by asking you, is it fair to say, based on all this stuff that we're talking about, that this is likely to be something of a drawn-out process, no matter what the ultimate outcome, whether this thing gets built or doesn't get built?
Oh, yes, it's clearly going to take a while. I was speaking recently with Councilman Kevin Canico, whose district covers where the new data center would be built, and he said that it's going to take 12 to 18 months just to do the permitting for this thing, and then the estimation is that it's going to take that assuming that it gets all its permits, it might take up to a decade to be fully built out. So yes, it's going to be a very long running thing if it does go ahead.
Thanks to contributor John Hurdle for his time this week. Links to our coverage of this story and the previous data center battle in Newark can be found on the Greens page at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. We hear from the newest member of Delaware's General Assembly following her special election victory earlier this week. That's next on The Green here on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. When Delaware's General Assembly reconvenes next week for a special session on property reassessment issues, there will be a new member in the House chamber. Democrat Alana Burry defeated Republican Nikki Miller in the House District 20 special election to replace former State Representative Stell Parker Selby. Parker Selby resigned in June, citing health concerns after suffering a stroke in December. Berry's victory in the Milton area district was a narrow one, a margin of just 121 votes. And Tuesday night, following that win, Delaware Public Media state politics reporter Sarah Petrowich spoke with Berry about her victory and what's next.
For starters, Representative Berry, tell me initial reactions following your win tonight.
I am just really excited by the momentum that we were able to build in under 30 days in this district. I am grateful for the voter turnout that we had. My understanding is we had the highest voter turnout in a special election ever in Delaware history, which to me just points to the fact that our voters care about the issues and they want their voice to be heard. And I'm excited to go to Dover and be the voice in Dover on behalf of Representative District 20.
Yeah, and can you talk to me a little bit about the race? Obviously, this was a narrow one, and I know, you know, you campaigned a lot on not necessarily your party, but really being a representative for the area. So, I mean, after all is said and done and all of early voting, just kind of reflecting back, how does it feel now?
Yeah, I've said time and time again throughout this campaign that the thing that inspires me the most is that Delaware is a state of neighbors. And that tomorrow, regardless of who you voted for, and I'm grateful for the folks who did vote or who you didn't, that tomorrow we're just all neighbors again. And it's my job as representative to work on behalf of everyone in this community. And so I'm excited to go out and hear their concerns and listen to the issues that matter to folks in this community. And then be the voice and the vote that they've been wanting at Legislative Hall.
There's a special session coming up in just a few days. So I'm curious, have you already been in discussions about, you know, the results still need to be certified. But then is it your understanding that you will be sworn in and being able to participate in that special session?
It's my understanding that prior to the special session, I would be sworn in, yes.
Got it. Okay, so really jumping right in. Do you have any thoughts initially just, you know, getting going with the whole reassessment process and school taxes and all of that prior to the special session?
Yeah, I think that the reassessment process is one of the, you know, the biggest issues facing our communities. It's directly impacted folks in Representative District 20 and in other places across the state. It requires us to think thoughtfully and strategically about how we both make sure that our schools are fully funded and have the supports that they need, while making sure that folks who have been living in communities and homes for a really long time are able to still live in those homes and those spaces and aren't taxed out of those properties. And so I'm actually really excited on day one, after I get sworn in, to be able to be a part of those conversations on behalf of the state and on behalf of this district, because I think it's issues like those that really matter to this community and really matter to folks' pockets and their livelihood moving forward.
Yeah, and speaking of other issues, you know, you've obviously been campaigning now for several weeks, and, you know, this has been at the forefront of your mind. But I'm curious, now that you've been elected, really, what are your core areas of focus that you want to bring to the legislature moving forward?
Yeah, I care, as I've said along this campaign, about our K-12 education system. I care about our early childhood education system. I care about infrastructure in this district in particular to make sure that we're still able to welcome folks who come to Delaware and they come to Sussex County and they fall in love and they want to stay here and build their lives here. But we have to do that in a way that's smart. We have to do that in a way that makes sure our roads can support it, that our schools can support it, that our water systems and sewage systems can support it. And so we have to be strategic about how we move forward with infrastructure. And I care about our healthcare system. I live in a district where we're having a healthcare crisis. We have a shortage of doctors, shortage of nurses. Specialists are really hard to schedule with for our everyday constituents. I myself have experienced that. And so we need to, again, think strategically, both on the front end, folks who are coming out of medical school and have the option to choose to live and work in this community, but also folks on the back end who who maybe can give an extra year or two before they retire to this community as well. And so those are the issues that I've talked and door knocked around throughout this campaign. Those are the issues that I've heard from constituents that they care about. And so I'm ready to go to Dover and bring that perspective to the legislature and be able to write policy around some of those issues.
And this seat was open because of a resignation of the former representative, Stelle Parker Selby, due to a stroke that she suffered. So she felt that she needed more time to recover. But that did stir up some discourse in the community about a lack of representation on their behalf during the legislative session. So I'm just curious, you know, do you have a message to those voters, you know, or people that felt like they had a lack of representation for the past several months, and how you plan to push forward now that you've been elected to this seat?
Yeah, what I can say to those voters and every voter in Representative District 20 is that I'm here to show up for you. And in Dover, I'm here to be a voice for you in Legislative Hall. I'm one of those constituents that lived in this district. And it matters to me that we have a voice, and it matters to me that we're able to have a vote on the floor. And so I raised my hand and I signed up to do that on behalf of every single voter in this district. And that's what I plan to do. And I need folks alongside me in this. I need to learn from and hear from other voters in this district. I need to understand better their issues and why they care about those things so that I can vote on behalf of the constituents of Representative District 20.
Thanks to new State Representative Alana Berry and our Sarah Petrowich for joining us on The Green this week. And The Green continues in a moment with a look at a new map that offers insight into the threat Delaware's marshes and wetlands face. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. It's summertime in the First State, a time when many of us head to the beaches. But on your way to the surf and sand, you'll likely pass through one of the state's most threatened habitats, its marshes and wetlands. DenRec recently released a map charting marsh migration, how wetlands are moving inland as sea levels rise, and how migrating marshes are bumping up against growing development. This week, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny chats with DenRec environmental scientist Allison Rogerson about the map and what it tells us.
Before we get to the marsh migration map, let me ask about the importance of wetlands and marshes to the state's ecosystem.
Wetlands are very important to our ecosystem for so many reasons. They provide wonderful habitat for both wildlife and plants. And some of those wildlife, some of those animals are commercially viable. So, you know, coastal wetlands provide nursery habitat for young fish and shellfish. That's supporting our economy. They're protecting our shorelines, protecting us from harsh weather and some flooding. They're beautiful to look at. They're rich. They are great storage for carbon. So in these days with climate and everything, carbon storage is really important. And water filtration. It's really hard for folks to imagine that something as like dirty and muddy as a wetland could clean your water. But honestly, the way they're built, they filter water. And as water filters down through all of those hydric soils, they're holding back contaminants. And so they're really important for water quality as well. And that's really important for everyone these days.
Could you talk a little bit about some of the species we have here in Delaware that are dependent on wetlands and on marshland for their habitat?
For coastal wetlands, we have a lot of species that are getting attention right now, such as salt marsh sparrows, some that are becoming a little more imperiled because of rising water levels and loss of habitat. So we have lots of herons and egrets and even gulls. You know, I don't think folks really realize that gulls will nest down in wetland grasses. So these coastal wetlands are really important for all of those birds. And then moving into like our forested or our freshwater habitats, we have a wonderful array of freshwater mussels that exist in our freshwater rivers and streams, as well as these unique isolated forested ponds. They're habitat to a lot of endemic species, both plant species, some really neat flowers and grasses that are specialized, endemic to Delaware, as well as a lot of frogs and salamanders that are very specialized to these wetland habitats, and they rely on them only for breeding grounds and for laying eggs. And without them, we would lose, you know, a lot of really rich species.
And I wonder what's sort of the state of our marshes and wetlands right now in terms of their overall health?
So through mapping efforts, which we update every 10 to 15 years, we are able to track acreage of wetlands across Delaware. And we do know that over several decades of doing this and repeating this, that we are on a trend where we are losing wetlands statewide, both in freshwater and tidal wetlands. And honestly, the causes of those losses have continued to be consistent over decades. So we are losing coastal wetlands to erosion and some natural forces. You know, development in coastal areas has been more controlled and regulated, but in non-tidal or freshwater wetlands, we're seeing wetland conversion to development and ag and for some forestry purposes as well. That's in terms of acreage. And then in terms of condition, that's something that we have been tracking, like watershed by watershed. We go out and we visit a handful of, you know, a slew of random wetland points in every watershed and rate, you know, the plant community and the hydrology there and what's in the buffer right around them. And are these wetlands able to perform these services that we spoke about in the beginning, these great ecosystem services? And it varies on where you are in the state, but, you know, we are seeing a lot of encroachment on buffers. We could use some more buffers on wetlands that allow them to do the wonderful services to their best, their fullest capacity. And, you know, we have lost some, so just direct conversion. And we have a lot of roads. You know, Delaware is a booming state. We have a lot of development, and so roads are coming in. We have with that some invasive species. And then we're a low-lying state, and we are trying to have a lot of development, and, you know, we have a lot of agriculture as well. And so we have an extensive system of drainage. And so that's impacting wetlands. You know, I think from that standpoint, we want to get water off of our land as quickly as possible. But from a wetland standpoint, we want that water to hold and soak in and everything. So they're kind of against each other.
Yeah, I think that's an important point that you make, and one that might often be overlooked. It's about more than just the acreage. It's about diversity of species, the hydrology, all of these different factors, because you can have a bunch of unhealthy wetlands, right?
Yes, yes, that is. So the mission for our program is to increase the acreage and function of wetlands in Delaware, because both are so important. And you can have direct impacts where you just straight out lose wetlands for their being just converted to another land use. But you can also have a lot of indirect impacts that reduce that wetland's ability to do all those wonderful services.
So you've updated the marsh migration map. What is marsh migration?
Marsh migration is a wonderful process where, you know, coastal wetlands in particular, the plants that live in wetlands along the coast have certain criteria and conditions that they want to live under. And as sea levels are rising, as water levels are rising, they are becoming more inundated or more flooded over time, and they're becoming stressed, and higher upland habitat is becoming more suitable for them. And so they start to grow. They're inching towards the upland and growing in higher elevation areas because the water, like they're moving with the water as water levels rise. And unfortunately, that means that the existing or the previous wetlands that are becoming more inundated and more stressed, they eventually will become flooded and will die off. And that is a wetland loss. And so the process of migration is that tidal wetlands are really creeping upland where areas are suitable for them, which is a wonderful process because, as we've just talked about, these coastal wetlands are so important. I mean, wetlands are important in general, but coastal wetlands are especially important because they are protecting our coasts. And we're having more frequent and more, you know, intense coastal storms. And these coastal wetlands are really able to buffer us from a lot of the dangerous wave energy and protecting our property and our infrastructure that are behind them.
I want to just kind of posit something to you and see if I'm on the right track. I'm picturing our coastal wetlands as being kind of this strip along the coast. And I feel like they're being pressured on two sides, from the ocean side because of rising sea levels, but then also from the landward side in terms of development and trying to create new land for housing, for agriculture, for whatever. Is that a fair way to think about this, that they're getting squeezed?
Absolutely. Yes, and that is something that we really focus on, is that there is the potential for wetlands to migrate upland into newly suitable habitat, but only if that property and those areas are available. And so we talk a lot about, land use is a big factor in areas that wetlands can migrate into, and having soft or natural shorelines and habitat that can undergo this habitat change. And so, yes, roads, impervious surfaces, development are going to be a hard stop and going to prevent these wetlands from migrating inland. And that is a concern for sure. They're feeling it on both sides. They're being squeezed from the water side by rising water levels, but in places they are restricted from migrating by land use and other conditions.
What are some of the findings from the updated marsh migration map?
You know, we approached this because we felt like we're all aware, we're living in a coastal state, and we're aware of rising sea levels and water levels, and we're not just hearing it, we're actually seeing it, we're feeling it, we're living it every day. And that's important for so many folks. And so we wanted to, instead of being kind of feeling helpless and uneasy about this happening and kind of out of control, and what does this mean for my property or my farmland or infrastructure, important things in our communities, we wanted to provide some information that could help us plan ahead and understand what's going on. And so the findings are really supposed to be something that can be used to educate, because some folks don't even know what marsh migration is. You know, they hear about sea level rise. They maybe are already seeing signs of it. They just don't understand what they're seeing. And so trying to just bring more awareness and exposure to this, to what is happening along our coast, and then putting more information behind that and showing them, here are the areas that are we find to be most suitable for potential wetlands in the future, and therefore what can we do to prepare for them. So, you know, we found from the model that there were over 34,000 acres of suitable land along our coast in Delaware for future migration, and that's varying levels. That's like minimally all the way to highly suitable. And then when we pare that down to really just the most suitable property, because we really want to focus on the best of the best first, that's about 21,000 acres. And most of that was in Kent and Sussex County, which is understandable. That's where most of our wetlands are. That's where most of our land is. So that makes sense. And we also found that what was really shocking to us, I think, and really informative for how we move forward, is that 65% of that highly suitable land, those 21,000 acres, is privately owned and therefore unprotected. And, you know, to be make sure that it's natural and soft to allow that migration. And so in terms of management and messaging, it's really important for us to recognize that. It was also really important for us to recognize that in terms of land use, where are these wetlands most likely to migrate into? A third of them are existing in farmland or agriculture. And another third of them are already in nine tidal or freshwater wetlands. And then about another 15% are currently forests. So it's important for us to know what type of habitat these wetlands are going to migrate into, so then we can approach the correct and the appropriate audiences.
Thanks to DENREC environmental scientist Allison Rogerson and our Martin Matheny for joining us on The Green this week. Up next, Arts Playlist, where Martin Matheny rejoins us to bring us his conversation with the Delaware Symphony Orchestra's new music director. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Earlier this year, the Delaware Symphony Orchestra began writing a new chapter in its long history, announcing the appointment of Argentinian-Italian conductor Michelle DeRusso as the orchestra's new music director, the first woman to hold that role in the symphony's century-plus history. In this edition of Arts Playlist, DeRusso sits down with Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny as she prepares to take the podium as the orchestra's music director for the first time in October.
So tell me a little bit about yourself and what drew you to orchestral music and conducting orchestral music.
Yeah, I think that, you know, for everyone, the path to conducting can be very different, right? For me, it wasn't the usual, you know, playing an orchestra and falling in love with conducting. For me, I started performing professionally, dancing and singing in a musical theater company. And I realized that although that was kind of the dream of my life, I felt like I didn't have control over the artistic vision and musical ideas that were being put forward. And so I wasn't sure if conducting was what I wanted to do. I was already studying conducting, but until I conducted an ensemble for the first time, and I was in front of a 60 more or less people ensemble, and I conducted Beethoven 5, the first movement. It was part of a final exam. When I did it, I don't know, I just felt this immense passion for it and just feeling the energy of the musicians, connecting with them without saying anything, right? It's all nonverbal language. It was the most special experience of my life. And I think that's the moment where I decided I would be a conductor. And so I kind of switched my focus a little bit and dedicated fully into conducting, kept dancing and working, doing that in Argentina. But then eventually I moved to the US to pursue conducting professionally, went to grad school here. And now I've been around 10 years in the US, which is kind of insane. So that's my story. It's kind of different.
As part of your audition here in Delaware, you got to spend some time with the orchestra. You conducted them in performance. And I wonder if you could kind of take me back to two different moments in that experience. The first time that you stepped up on the podium in front of that orchestra in a rehearsal, and then the end of the final concert that you conducted them on. And tell me what was going through your mind in those instances.
Yeah, so the first time I conducted them was during a guest conducting week before the search even opened up. I was just, I guess, doing one of their masterworks. And already then I felt there was a special connection with the ensemble and with the audience and with everyone at the team. And I was like, you know, I didn't even know there was going to be a search yet at that time. But I thought, oh, it would be so amazing to work here, you know, when you feel like it feels like home. And just working with everyone was such a great experience at that time, that I thought, oh, I hope I'm back. I hope, you know, I can keep working this relationship. So then when the position opened up, I definitely applied. And, you know, the search is quite grueling for everyone. It takes a long time. So I would say that after my final week of the search, I felt very happy with myself. I felt that I had done good work, very intense week, you know, besides the conducting aspect of it, which is really important. We have to go through a lot of other interviews with the search committee, with the board, with the union representative, with our audiences in a community Q&A. So by the end, I thought, okay, I've done my best. I thought I had really done musically what I wanted to do with the orchestra. I thought I had taken them to the level that I wanted to take them for our concerts. We had great concerts, and I'm just so happy to start this new journey officially with them. And I'm just so looking forward about all the possibilities and things we can do together.
I wonder, can you talk a little bit about your approach to putting together a program and even putting together a full season?
Right. Yeah, that's a tricky thing, right? You have 5 subscription works, and sometimes you always want to add more concerts, but you always want to do more. But as of now, we have 5 subscription works, and then we have our chamber series, which sometimes is a small ensemble but conducted, and sometimes it's maybe just a brass quintet, right? So we have different offers for different audiences and, of course, different repertoire. My goal throughout these years to come is to really embed ourselves in the community and really have strong partnerships with everyone, because our mission is to serve our community, right? So we're bringing the highest possible level of music making and of artistry, but it is also dedicated to the people that want to come see us. So I want to always have that in mind. And of course, as I get to know everyone, I'll know what things work best. And then I think it is a balance between what the orchestra needs to grow and to improve, because we're always, you know, as artists, we're perfectionists, you know. So we're always thinking on what can we do better, what repertoire can we learn that is new, that is exciting. And so I think about that, but I also think about the repertoire that maybe the audience wants to see that hasn't seen yet. And this season is like just a glimpse. I think the next season will be artistically more mine in some ways, because I'll have more time to think about it. And we're already kind of working on it, because, you know, we work ahead. And also, I want a season that will have a coherent idea from beginning to end, and it's not just, you know, potpourri of things. And so this year, I thought we were really mindful of including, you know, we have some Tchaikovsky Symphony No. 4, we have Beethoven Symphony 3, we have a sci-fi concert too. And then, you know, we're doing Strauss, the Rose and Cavalier, we have Firebird. So I feel there's a little bit of everything. We have new music too. We're doing Lieberman, the Flute Concerto. We're going to be playing some Anna Klein. So there's a little bit of everything. And I'm just excited about maybe bringing the audience with me in this artistic vision throughout the years and introduce them maybe to things that they think they're a bit crazy, but that I know that they'll understand.
I want to sort of shift gears a little bit and talk about classical music, the larger sort of industry, and looking at the kind of the top 20 US orchestras right now, there are only two women conductors represented out of that group. And I wonder what, or music directors, I should say, what can we do as audiences, as enthusiasts, and what do we need to do to increase that equality kind of at the upper echelon of orchestral music?
Wow, that's a great question. I think it's tricky, because it not only depends on the acceptance from the audience, right, that is maybe ready to see a woman conductor. It also depends on the board, right, of accepting and not gatekeeping those positions, because they do have a really important role to play, and they can help a lot if they want to. So I think that the more we can diversify our boards, our audiences, I think we can make our orchestras and our conductors look more like the demographics of the places we're in. So I think that's crucial. It is also crucial to start the education earlier. So I think schools, teachers have a very important role to play in encouraging women to do it and to giving them the, I would say, the resources to do it. And I think that's part of it why we co-created with some of my colleagues Girls Who Conduct, because we thought if we can catch girls when they're starting to even think about it and they want to know what the field looks like, what are the things they need to learn, then giving them the tools to tell them this is what the profession is looks like. These are other possibilities of things you could do, right?
Yeah, I definitely wanted to ask you about Girls Who Conduct, and how can people find out more about that program?
Yeah, so right now, what we try to do is to create partnerships with orchestras and try to bring workshops so that these girls can have actually like practical experience in front of a professional ensemble. So we do that. We have a website where you can find us and you can submit any questions you have, or if you want to, we're trying to form a board for it too. So if you want to be a part of our board, and then we do sometimes online, we try to do it once a year, but this online classes where we introduce, we have our six women conductors. I'm the orchestra one, someone is in opera, choral, and more academic wind band conducting. And so we all present about different topics, being it programming, actual technique for conducting, career paths and how to learn more about all of these things, about workshops, and we just provide all of these resources. So if you want to get in touch, you can go to girlshood.connect, our website, but also you can get in touch with me. I'm happy to chat.
You know better than almost anybody, a conductor's job doesn't begin and end on the podium. There's a huge fundraising and community engagement aspect to it as well. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about some of your plans for community engagement and especially engaging with younger audiences.
It's so crucial. I feel so a music director, the title is such because it's not just for the orchestra. I feel like you're the music director, of course, of the organization, but of your community, right? Of the people that are following you. And so for me, especially because I'm new, you know, to Delaware, but it's so beautiful already, and there's so many things I would like to do. But I think it's important for me to get to know my community, and that's what I want to do during the first year, to attend events and to see what where people like to gather, what people like to see, what people like to do. And everybody has been already so welcoming. I think it's going to be really easy to feel a part of this community. Besides doing that, we were talking about ideas of things we would like to do, but I came with ideas of doing, you know, pop-up concerts in different areas. So it could be like in a farmer's market, or maybe there's a festival happening. I think that people need to see us. We need to go to them too. I also think it is important to provide different kinds of experiences and not just masterworks. And so we're working on an explorer concerts, which are for schools, to see if we can bring them into the schools as well, not just have them at the theater, have family concerts that are specifically for families so that it's at a time where they can come, where they feel they can bring their children. I would say the last one that I'll say about this for younger audiences that are not kids, that are like, you know, young adults, I think social media is quite crucial. So we need to get on that bandwagon on having them in our audience.
So really breaking down some of those walls between the orchestra and the audience.
Yes, absolutely. I would like to do that because, you know, I don't think anyone wants classical music to become a museum, right? And I think it's a live art with people that are alive doing it, right? So somehow I think we need to find a way how to bring this to everyone in this world of globalization and technology that we live in. And you know, I believe our product is excellent. And so then how can we make people love it as much as we do? Because I feel like people love music. It's not that. So there's somewhere, I would say in the whole classical industry, somewhere where we're not connecting entirely with our audiences.
Well, Michelle DeRusso, thank you so much. Best of luck. Welcome to Delaware, and look forward to seeing you on the podium in just a couple of months.
Yeah, can't wait to see you all, get to meet you all. And please, I keep saying this because I really mean it. At the end of the concert, I would love to meet you all. So just wait for me to dry the sweat off 5 minutes, and I'll be out there talking to all of you to see what you thought and what you liked, what you didn't like. I really want to know.
Thanks to the Delaware Symphony Orchestra's new music director, Michelle DeRusso, and our Martin Matheny for joining us on Arts Playlist. You can learn more about Girls Who Conduct at girlswhoconduct.org. For information on the Delaware Symphony Orchestra's upcoming season, visit delawaresymphony.org. And to hear more from Michelle DeRusso, including her influences and her favorite musical, check out the full version of this interview at delawarepublic.org. And that'll do it for this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, contributor John Hurdle, and Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny and Sarah Petrowich. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Bernsing. Thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into A First State of Mind.